Welcome to the Valley College Connection, where John Kawai and Scott Wigand, two Valley professors, engage in a conversation about success with educators and students. Each week, they'll sit down with a different guest to find out ways each of us have had to plan, persevere, and overcome to where we are now. The show will also highlight resources and services that are working to make a difference at Valley College.
So for today's podcast, we're going to do something a little bit different. Rather than interview a guest, John and I are going to discuss a topic that comes up all the time with our students, with each other, and it's the topic of happiness.
There's been an issue that's been happening at just about every college where we're finding that the number of depressed students on campuses are overwhelming. Last year, Yale started a class on happiness, and it was a mob scene where they had over 2,000 students trying to enroll in a class on how to be happy. Harvard had the same thing happen a few years ago, where they also started studying why are our students so unhappy when they're so successful. And again, they had thousands of students try to enroll into a single class.
And is this a class that's a required class, elective class?
It's an elective class where, you know, there's no reason to take it to graduate other than it's a theme that's been replicated over and over at most colleges in this country, is that we're seeing the number of students who are depressed just skyrocketing at every college. Now, The Atlantic had an article about this where they found that 80% of elite students are anxious and 50% are depressed. So the question is, how do you become a successful student and still stay in that 20% where you're happy?
Hmm. And do you think, based on the research that you've seen, is this something that's particular to elite colleges? Is this something that we would see at community colleges? Is this something that we see, you know, in society as a whole, sort of the spike in depression and anxiety that people are feeling?
It's looking like this is generational. What we're finding out is that when we talk to millennials, students who are 23 to 38, we're finding out that they just have a large number of young adults who just don't have friends. So we found that when they've studied this, roughly 1 in 5, 1 in 4 millennials have no close friends. And in comparison to the boomers, only 1 in 10 don't have a close friend. And if you go down the list of, do you have friends? Do you have a best friend? Do you have someone you can call? We find that the number of millennials, despite the fact that they're more connected because of the iPhone and social media, they really don't have real relations.
Mm.
Now, part of the issue, I think, has to do with time. They're finding out that elite students study till 1 or 2 o'clock every night. And this is just starting from high school. So one is, we know that top students are sleep deprived. They're right. Coming in just exhausted. When I looked at what Yale did, I didn't take the whole course, but when you listen to the professor and sort of the brass tacks of what they feel is important, they're finding out that when you buy things, that stimulus you have of buying something, it's something you get used to. So if you buy a dress, makes you happy. You buy a shirt, makes you happy. You buy a car, makes you happy. You got to buy another car to feel that same kind of joy. It's not lasting. And every time you buy the same thing over and over and over, the happiness quotient just goes down. So one of the things that they've been trying to stress at Yale is to buy experience, not things.
Huh.
So it seems as if you have good memories that seems to sort of endure in terms of your soul a lot more than you buying things. The other thing that, and this has been in a lot of different places, your mind tends to dwell on relative comparisons, meaning that if you're with a whole bunch of smart people, you might be a smart person, but you'll feel dumb. Because relative to who's in that group, that's how I feel. So one of the things they've talked about in Yale is just doing things for other people. That if you are giving to other people, if you're not focused on your own success, if you just sort of contribute to someone else's success, that being with someone who is struggling and being a part of their success, that tends to put your mind in a better frame.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, the fact that there's courses on this that are taught at Yale and Harvard, and it's, you know, framed as like, oh, here's what the science says, it's good to hear the science, but I mean, also that's like, yeah, no kidding, right? It's the old adage of like, you can't buy happiness, of course. Be of service to others. Stop focusing on yourself and you'll be happier. I mean, are those the, like, you know, paraphrasing in other ways what the message is?
It sounds like the Bible almost.
Right. I mean, it's not like new information about how we find happiness, but perhaps, as you're saying, from a generational perspective, and if we're talking about millennials, we're talking about Generation Z, and especially with Generation Z as being this group that has had the most exposure and has grown up with social media and living in this reality or this world where there's all sorts of comparisons happen all the time, social comparison, this sort of, you know, fear of missing out that happens. Those are the things that we didn't have before, right? That are creating this other sort of reality. I came across research too that was along these lines. It was the work of Jonathan Haidt, mm-hmm. who's the social psychologist. I think he teaches out of NYU, but he was looking at the same sort of thing, depressive episodes and the spike in them that happen, especially with girls, right? And it's middle school up through high school. And there's a huge difference between what happens with the girls and what happens with the boys.
Right.
And as research starts to sort of unpack again, the impact that social media is having on that, which is, you know, for anybody, of course, who has kids that are that age or family members or anybody in that sort of circle, and you start to see that, all sorts of red flags go up. It raises the question, begs the question of, yeah, what do you do about it?
So when are you going to get your kid an iPhone? Have you guys considered it yet?
He asks for it, right? So he's 9 years old. His cousins, my nieces, who are one's in middle school and one's in high school, both have iPhones, right? And so he's asking for it. And we keep sharing with him, like, well, why do you need it? Like, who are you calling? As John and I have talked about before, we homeschool. I'm homeschooling my son. And so it's not as though he's at school all day long where he needs a phone to contact somebody to pick him up or do something like that. And so we haven't given him any definitive answer, but there's definitely been a pushback of us just saying, like, no, you don't need a phone. Why do you need a phone at this point? You know, you have an iPad. You can do things with that, but you don't have that phone in your pocket with all those sort of connections. Now, the work with Jonathan Haidt that he was talking about that was interesting is that there was almost a group effort amongst the parents in some of the middle schools where they were trying to have an agreement amongst themselves about what age they were going to let the kids in the middle school have a phone, because it becomes, again, the fear of missing out. If one or two kids have that phone and they're, you know, in eighth grade, then everybody's going to want to have the phone. And so trying to figure out how long can we hold off on this before everybody starts getting the phone. Yeah. How about you for your kids?
My daughter's 11. We're getting to the point where more and more of her friends are on the same sort of Instagram account, TikTok account. I think my daughter struggles with these issues of anxiety and just being going through puberty and trying to make friends and have friends. And we have these conversations that I don't know that being on a phone is going to help you more. But then there's the other question of, well, how do I make friends then?
Right.
If everyone's on the phone, then how do I make friends? So we've been having these healthy conversations with her. I think she would describe them as frustrating conversations. I think we've come to the point where in eighth, when my son goes to high school, we'll have to get a phone just for safety's sake.
Sure. Right.
But, you know, there's a negative correlation between happiness and the amount of time you spend on your phone. I go both ways. So I was a video gameaholic. I mean, I love video games.
Right.
My parents went the direction of, you will have no games until you finish everything in your life, and afterwards we'll give it to you with an eyedropper.
It's like earn a reward, do all this work, and then you get X amount of time to play.
And I was just this ridiculous drug addict, just wishing for just one more hit of video games. And when I went to college and there was no one to like watch me, you know, I was just insane with games because finally the faucet was open. So I think with like video games with my son, we've been trying to have him use video games as a break.
Okay.
So there's this idea of, how long can you study? And what researchers have found that after about 20 minutes, you start decreasing. And once you get to about 45 minutes, your brain's pretty much worthless. And this is for the average college student.
45, wait, say it again.
Okay, so
20 minutes is the max?
When you're lecturing,
okay,
the students can have a good attention span for basically 20 minutes.
Okay.
After 20 minutes, it's diminishing returns.
Okay.
To about 45, 50 minutes.
Okay.
Now, the idea is to take 10 or 15 minute breaks, and then your concentration power can come back. So part of the problem with sort of depression in these students is that they think that the way I study for 5 hours is sit in front of all my books for 5 hours, but really they're sitting there for 45 minutes, and 4 hours and 15 minutes is just guilt. You're not really productive. You're just feeling guilty. You just, nothing will go into your brain. And you're just trying to pass the clock so you feel better.
Okay.
Now, there's this thing called the Pomodoro technique where what they do is they say go 50 on, 10 minutes off. Usually, it's my kids, I go 45 on, 15 minutes off. So that way, by the time that you get to 45 minutes, your brain is off anyways. So go take a 15-minute break and do something you enjoy. Video games, watch a video. Have something that you really care about that makes you happy.
Check your social media.
Right. That's when you check your social media. Mm-hmm. So what you do is you think about studying in terms of 45-minute sprints.
Okay.
So when you're at 45 minutes, especially the first 20 minutes, know what you're going to do in that first 20 minutes because that's when you're most productive.
Interesting.
So part of the problem when I work with struggling students is they'll say, I studied for 5 hours, and I'll ask them, what does that look like?
Right.
And they'll go 5 hours in the library. And I go, well, you probably wasted 4 hours.
Right, right.
But if you do this 45-15, 45-15, you can pretty much count in your brain working for all 5 hours. So I have a niece right now who was struggling in school. I work with her on a Saturday. We'll go through all her math. And I'll tell her that you're about 7 hours away from understanding this material. So within the next 3 days, you need 7 hours. She asked me, but how can I count on my brain working 6 or 7 hours? And if you do this 45-15, you can pretty much book your time. You can pretty much count on that seventh hour being almost as productive as that first hour.
Wow.
Now, if you think of it that way, right, where you're not feeling overwhelmed by the 7 hours, you're just thinking it's a 45-minute sprint, then I get to do 15 minutes of what I enjoy.
Right.
So with my son, I said, let's let video games be part of your day.
Okay.
And that's part of your 15 minutes. So after you do 45, what do you love to do? Find a 15-minute game, put an alarm on, and then go again. So when he finishes the day, he feels like he's been playing bits and pieces of computers all day. He doesn't feel like he's been studying all day.
Interesting.
And then the other thing that's really important is after you finish, have half an hour of something you really enjoy.
Okay.
So don't clean the dishes. Don't do chores. I usually tell my wife, like, give him that 30 minutes after he finishes for a reward for the day.
Okay.
So that way you sort of, you know, it's sort of Pavlovian where you want to finish feeling good,
mm-hmm.
like you work for something, rather than finishing and then saying, I just have more, another task to do.
Right, right.
So what they found out with people who make a schedule, if you tell someone, okay, make a schedule for your studying, if the first thing they write down is, I have to do this much studying, they usually don't keep the schedule. But if you ask them, what do you want to do this week? What's the most important thing that you want to work for? So when I was in school, it'd be, I want to have Saturday off so I can goof around. Then you schedule your work so you can have Saturday off. Rather than saying, I've got to get 20 hours of study in, you have to say, I have to make sure I get to go out on Saturday.
That's just a different way of framing
it. It's a different way of framing. But right. They found out is that if you frame your day around the things that you enjoy,
right.
You tend to keep your schedule, whereas you frame your day under the things that you hate.
Right, and just having to get it done.
Yeah, you just don't do it.
Right, right. Well, that makes sense. That's interesting, man. You know, with my son, he's at the age now where he's just getting into video games. And we kind of held back and tried to do everything we could to not go down that road, which is kind of ironic because as a kid and I grew up, you know, I played video games. Had the Atari, had the Nintendo, had the PlayStation, all that stuff. But we were hesitant with it. And so it wasn't until this last year that he got the Nintendo Switch, mm-hmm. right? And so now he's playing on that. And then he discovered Fortnite. And he's playing that with now his cousins and his friends. And, you know, for me, who was really not a gamer, to see sort of the interesting type of interaction that happens with that game is they're live playing with headphones and talking to each other. The sort of gravity pull that has to want to do that and to continue to want to do that and to continue to want to talk about that and to be a part of that is on one hand fascinating, on the other hand, like scary. And so what we've set up is kind of something similar to what you're describing, but with different parameters, right? So he's earning time now in order to play that by doing other things. So like, hey, if you want to play, you have to read for an hour. So get an hour of reading in, and then that will buy you 30 minutes of game time.
Yeah.
You know, and so we sort of go back and forth into these chunks. The model that you're describing, though, about the 45 and the 15, it's interesting. We'll have to play around with that a little bit to kind of see how that works.
Well, right now, your son doesn't have to be efficient yet, right? So
no.
You can sort of work to that.
Right.
The one thing I sort of forbade my son to do was to do online gaming, only because that's the most addictive one, because you're playing with people.
And yeah.
So it was one of those things where I said, you know, try a little pot, but don't do heroin. So, you know, like, have the games that you like on your iPad, but just know that the online gaming is what sucks you in for 10 hours.
Yeah, right. You can see how it happens. And again, if we didn't have if we didn't have limitations on it, he would play for hours. I mean, you hear about people playing and not eating. I see it in a 9-year-old, like, without a doubt, you know? It's like we have to pull him away. Stop, okay. And then likelihood of him wanting just to talk about that, obsess about every detail about it, research about it. I mean, the researching part's good. I appreciate that. But I mean, there's a total level of obsession with it, which is, it's a little bit scary. It's a little bit scary to see.
Yeah. I mean, I was the generation where they were trying to keep the kids away from computers. And then they found out that all the people who played computers became engineers.
Right. Your story, right? I mean, your love of computers and love of gaming, PhD in computer science, right?
Right.
So it's interesting how that kind of plays out.
Yeah. And that, so if my parents had let me play more, I think I would have done better.
Right.
I think that all the time because, you know, I was the generation where they were hacking. So they were hacking and getting into all kinds of things. Those people are now, you know, owners of companies.
Right, right.
And I was really in the right generation, and my parents just sort of kept me away from it. And you look at, you know, the people who became really big in these companies, a lot of them are just ex-hackers.
Right.
So I had the right age, the right passion.
Yeah.
And it just turned out that my parents just didn't trust that, you know, that was a socially healthy place to go.
And that isn't that, you know, kind of a typical trend, though, for parents not to trust whatever the most sort of current technology is. It's the unknown. We don't know how it's going to play out. It's so different from what it was in our generation or what we saw before.
Right.
It's like our natural inclination to be fearful of it.
Right. Yeah. So like you look at like YouTube, or you look at my kids now, they speak better than we spoke. Could they speak as if they're on YouTube?
Huh. Right. This performative sort of aspect to it.
We take videos of them.
Right.
In terms of my daughter learned how to bake just from watching YouTube videos. So you sort of, I'm more on the, let's just embrace it. Is that there? You need a new skill set for the next generation. It's going to be a lot more marketing.
Right, right. Certainly.
And all of that sort of self-marketing seems to be inherent in what they learned in YouTube.
Right.
So they're just a lot more ahead in those areas. We just didn't think that way.
Yeah. And they're not even necessarily aware, or maybe they are, I don't know, that those are skills that they're learning. Coming back to happiness then.
Yeah.
So you've outlined a couple strategies here in terms of ways that students can approach studying that will help them from getting burned out, from feeling anxiety, stress. If they're feeling anxiety and stress, that's going to lead to unhappy.
Right.
Right. What else were you seeing in the research? Any other trends or patterns?
There's quite a few. So going back to what we were talking about before, I remember at church they used to talk about focus on joy, not happiness. Joy is something that, whether someone cuts you off in traffic or not, you still feel it. Happiness is someone buys you ice cream, when the ice cream is gone, you feel sad.
Fleeting.
Right. So what they found out in Japan was that Japan has the saddest group of millennials in the world. Korea has the second saddest. When they started doing interviews of these people from Japan, they found out that what stands out the most is that the younger people in Japan who focus on their own success as the primary sort of focus of their life, they find that they are the saddest people in the country.
Right.
And they find that same thing in Korea also. So I think part of it too is that it's really not about GPA, but about finding some passion, something that you enjoy. Even with this little game I play of 45 on, 15 minutes off, sometimes when I work with students, they go, I don't have anything that makes me happy for 15 minutes.
Sad.
So even on that sort of base level when you're trying to work with them, if we had no studying and nothing to do and you just had a half an hour, what would you go do? What would you want to do?
If you don't have an answer for that, if you're like, well, I don't know, nothing makes me happy. I'm not interested in anything. I have no passions.
Right.
That's a, in and of itself, a depressive spot to be in.
Right.
You know?
And Harvard had a similar class there. And when I listened to the guy from Harvard, his focus was on context switching, meaning don't do two things at once.
Don't multitask.
Don't multitask.
Right.
When you work, you work. When you study, you study. When you're happy, you're happy. And don't try to parent and study at the same time.
Their big
goal was to get people to like study when they're studying, socialize when they're socializing, just don't mix them.
Huh. Interesting. Okay.
And then you sort of find that too. I find myself grading and watching YouTube and just, you know, burning hours of ineffective grading with not really concentrating on something I enjoy.
Right.
But just something repetitive. And yeah, I do find that when I just do one thing at a time.
Right.
I do feel better. Now, part of the problem too is just basically hours.
Okay.
So we found out that elite students study about 3 to 5 hours a night.
Okay.
Okay.
And is this in college or is this in high school, prepping for college?
Yeah.
So
the sad thing is this, is that middle school students study more than the average high school students.
Okay.
The average high school students study less than the average college student.
So now is this the middle school students who are tracking to be in AP high school classes? I mean, is this a track thing?
No.
It has to be.
It's finding out that the kids who are elite students,
right,
they study like crazy. So now you look at an elite student in high school, they usually go to sleep between 1 a.m. and 2 a.m.
After 3 to 5 hours of studying. So they started studying at 7 p.m., studied up through 1.
Right, because they're doing all their, you know, extra things, band and such and such. But we're finding out that the students who don't study really don't study.
Mm-hmm.
So now you have a skill level gap. And then when you get to college, it's even more striking. So when you and I went to college, we had to spend about 40 hours of studying on average.
Mm-hmm.
So the better students did 60. And now you're looking at the average student in college, a full-time student, they study about 17 hours.
A week.
That's
okay.
It.
Right. Full-time.
Right.
Okay.
So the question is, how are you going to be happy if you just don't have the repetition in there?
Hmm.
I mean, we're talking a third of the hours that you and I had to study in order to get through our classes. Now, there are efficiencies. We have email. Research is way faster. You're not doing the Dewey Decimal System in the library,
mm-hmm,
going into the stacks.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, you know, there's also a frustration students have because there's just not enough pure hours that they're putting in.
Right. But so back it up a second and unpack this a little bit more for me, because I might have missed it, but there was a jump there between the more, you know, not having enough time to study, wanting more time to study, and that equating to happiness. But you're pointing out that the research is showing that, you know, these elite students who are studying for these big chunks of time, 3 to 5 hours a day, are the ones who are depressive.
Right.
Right. So just because you have enough time to study and you're studying and you can get it in doesn't equate to happiness. And
right.
Then there's this component to it of you could study, you know, however many hours a day, but if you're studying about something that you don't care about, you have no passion for, right? Or on the other side of it, you have no passion, you're not going to be happy.
There's a lot of reasons why people are unhappy, right?
Okay.
One is we flunk a lot of students in this school.
Okay.
And there's no happiness in that.
Okay.
So we have sort of these two groups of students in our colleges, one which are killing themselves.
Okay.
And then the other, which absolutely are not. And when you look at, and this is not true of our students. Our students have a lot of other sort of responsibilities outside of school. But when you look at an average college and you say, well, what's happening outside of those 17 hours? It's not work.
Mm-hmm.
It's not family responsibilities. They're just dead time.
Okay.
So there's this sort of weird track where we have these one group of students who are doing less and less and less, and a lot of them just aren't passing.
And they're not happy.
And they're not happy.
Because you're not feeling fulfilled. You're not being successful. You're not finding that, hey, I accomplished this, I got that good grade, you know, whatever that may be that's going to trigger your happiness. So they're not getting the happiness there. And then there's the other group who are killing themselves to study.
Right. So there's a famous poker player who trains poker players. And, you know, when you play poker, you're anxious. And he said, fear grows where knowledge lacks, meaning that you're always going to be anxious. You're always going to be unhappy when you're fearful of your circumstances. And the things that fix that is repetition and knowledge. So I come from the Steve Jobs sort of framework. And it's really unfair because Steve Jobs is one of those, do the thing that you love and then throw your whole self into it. And it was really easy for me because I knew exactly what I wanted.
Right.
And the problem is that there's a lot of students here who just don't know what they want.
Right.
And I think a lot of that requires them to change their pattern. If you've gone 18 years of your life walking the same road, walking the same streets, talking to the same people, and you haven't found what you enjoyed, one more year of the same people and the same streets aren't going to change that.
Hmm.
And, you know, like finding what you like to do is a proactive thing. It is putting yourself around people that you aren't normally around.
Right.
It is stuff like service learning where you be around things that might be exciting.
Right.
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 We had one guest who talked about just going on Yelp and just Yelping every job that she was interested in and calling every person,
right,
just strangers, to say, do you like what your job is?
Right.
And I think one is there's a proactiveness you need to find that thing that you enjoy.
There is, and not to interrupt your train of thought, but just so I don't lose this thread here, I think the piece that's critical to what you're talking about, and we've touched on this before with other guests, is curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And it begs the question in my mind about how our current institutional systems, classes, the things that people go through, oftentimes it squashes curiosity. you know, when you're forced to study 5 hours a night to get to this particular GPA, to get to this particular elite institution, to get to this particular job, I mean, all of the that sort of pressure, all of those sort of expectations, at what cost does that come? And how is it that as you know, families, cultures, as society, like what are we able to do from the earliest of time and as people go on to continually find ways to cultivate, you know, curiosity? It's like, it seems to me, as far as learning goes and as far as education goes, that that's the most precious thing to protect. And for the folks who don't have a passion, who don't have an interest, it seems to me that that's tied back to curiosity and not having the intellectual curiosity there that sort of lights the fire within you. It's a fear I've had it myself because I've seen it with other people. And I've wondered and I've sat back and I've been like, oh my God, like, do I have enough hobbies? Like, what is my life just work, right? And I have that fear that I've seen too many times with folks, their identity and their life just revolves around what they do as their job. And for some folks, you know, like you were describing the Steve Jobs sort of type of personality, like they love their work is their life. Like it's a one for one, right? But for a lot of folks, that's not the case. You know, they're working a job that is paying the bills, right? That's the job that they have to do. And you work that job for 30 years or whatever it is. And when you go to retire and you don't have that job to do anymore, they don't have any passions. They don't have any hobbies. And it's like, oh my God, now what do I do? Well, I'll just keep working because that's all that I know. Freaks me out. It scares me, man.
I think for me, it's like I'm not freaked out about that because I already know that's where I am.
See, that might be like I might be a few years behind you, right? Yeah. But you have hobbies, passions, curiosities outside of this, no?
Yeah, I cook a lot. I garden. Okay. I have things I like to do. But yeah. I've always been lucky in that I've always been aggressive in doing the part of the work that I enjoy, and saying no to the part of the work that I don't enjoy. Okay. So usually what I do when I get a job, and this has been any job, I just go in there and I do everything. Anything that anyone wants me to do, I just say yes.
Right.
I just want to see as broad of a spectrum of what everyone else is doing and what's possible.
Right.
And then I start volunteering for everything I enjoy.
Okay. I've seen you do that here.
Right.
Yeah.
So then what happens is I get to do the job as my hobby.
Wow.
Right. So I have a YouTube channel. I make YouTube videos not because I have to. No one pays me to. Mm-hmm. But I make YouTube videos for math because I enjoy doing it. I know what questions my students are going to ask me before they even ask me.
Mm-hmm.
And if I could just give it to them.
Right.
And then they can pause it and look at it and watch it and then come back to me and spend 5 minutes with me instead of 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And this is repeatable.
Right.
Why wouldn't I?
Yeah.
The same thing with this podcast. This has allowed me to just walk through campus and meet people that I would have never met. So, you know, my original job was working on movies. I mean, that's a hobby. Right. If you didn't pay me to do it, I would have done it anyways.
Yeah.
Now, what I do on this campus is I get to do some creative things like this podcast. I sometimes do seminars that, you know, aren't asked for. And people go, oh, that's kind of cool. We kind of like that seminar.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I can go explore something in my field or just some random field that I have a general curiosity for.
Right.
And have an audience to talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
For me is that whole Steve Jobs thing where if you find your hobby in your job, what a great job you have.
Yeah.
Right. So I get to do a lot of things that a lot of other people don't do, but then part of that takes work.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing a lot of free work because it creates relationships and also just gives me a knowledge of this campus that some of the things I really enjoy are really possible.
Right. And that sort of keeps people, I think, inspired, motivated, optimistic about what we can do, what the potential is for how we're connecting with each other, with our students, what the college is going to be able to do.
Yeah. I mean, for a while, I was trying to figure out how to scam the whole interview system, how to create resumes for professors, how to get them in, why aren't they getting hired, how to work with them in a way to frame what they say. Just turn it into a factory that the people I meet, if they have a dream to be a full-time professor, let's get them on that track. Let's get them in that place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, it keeps my brain active.
That's interesting. It's an interesting sort of insight into how you're approaching, you know, work and what you're doing here.
Yeah. So I do the same thing with my students. I have a few students who, you know, I always offer if you want to get scholarships or if you want to get into, there's some really great programs out there that are hard to get into. And if you want to get into this, figure out a way. Let's tell me your story. I'll write a good letter of recommendation. Let's see how we can hustle our way into there.
See, it's that hacker mentality that you shared before from your generation, right? What's the hack on this? How do you sort of undo what the system is, right?
Right.
Figure the way into it.
So I have two students right now with really interesting backgrounds, and they want a really remarkable, this usually doesn't happen to someone like me, and just trying to figure out our way to get to that dream.
Right.
That's exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. I might have derailed the conversation for a minute there with my curiosity point.
I think there's a couple key things, right? I think one is having rewards during the day.
Okay.
A small reward every hour, a small reward at the end of the day. I think two, having a big picture for what you want in life.
Okay.
So if you're working towards something that is meaningful to you, then it stops being a grind.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think there is this idea of really cherish experiences, mm-hmm. not stuff.
Right, right.
And then some of the things that we haven't touched on is that I think having a broader mind for other people. Now, this is an issue with progressives, and I'm a progressive, but we found that one in four college students believe that if someone doesn't believe the right thing, they should be shouted down or stopped.
Yeah, call out culture.
Yeah, and that's one out of four. And you're going to be pissed off if you cannot get you're just not going to get a room of 40 people who are going to believe all the right thoughts that you might believe that they need to believe.
But how boring would that reality be? Like, who would?
But it is a reality, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
There are people on campus who believe my job is to police. Right. Wrong thoughts.
Right.
And if that's what your job is on this campus, there's no way you can possibly be happy because no one's going to believe everything you believe.
Mm-hmm.
We also found that two out of three conservatives on a college campus do not feel free to share in a class.
Oh, I'm sure.
Right?
Yeah.
And we're finding that about half of moderates and a third of even progressives feel that this is just not a place where I can share.
And this is supposed to be a space of, you know, the exchange of ideas, right?
Yeah.
Let's have this almost sacred space where we can entertain ideas, hear each other's ideas, challenge ideas without it being personal.
Yeah. So I get a little chippy in my class where mm-hmm. I kind of like will touch hot topic issues just to sort of let people know that what college is a space for people to try out different ideas.
What's the information from the community college in Chicago? You'd shared that was sort of what they were telling their students from
sure.
the get-go.
So
right?
We have this problem, let's say Harvard Law. Harvard Law famously stopped teaching law about rape law.
Okay.
Okay. So what happened was not students who were raped were talking about it because they would give a trigger warning saying we're going to talk about rape and law and the laws surrounding that tomorrow. So if you are uncomfortable, don't come and you're not responsible for the material. There are people then protesting to say, you know what? You can't ever say that. Just have that conversation because you may make someone uncomfortable.
Mm.
And it's become this thing where colleges said, well, there are certain things we just will no longer teach.
Right.
So they scared Harvard Law students, Harvard Law professors, to stop going over those laws, which then doesn't help the cause.
Right.
So there have been different tracks of these. There was a guy in UCLA who was attacked because I think someone was doing surveys which were not scientific.
Okay.
And he had said, hey, this is not research. And they said, yeah, but I feel like it's right. Like, your feelings really don't matter.
Mm-hmm.
And that became a thing where he just stopped working with researchers. We've had other issues at the Claremont Colleges where a student who was a non-traditional student there went to a dean and said, I feel really uncomfortable here, like I don't fit. And she, you know, had a great conversation with her. She wrote an email, said like, you know, my door is always open, you know, especially for students who are non-traditional Claremont students. And they had a riot. I mean, they had protests. The dean finally just quit. And, you know, I thought that was the conversation we were having.
Right, right.
And there was no space for it. So I think part of also this sadness comes from the policing of ideas.
Okay.
Right. And University of Chicago then, to every freshman, they sent out this letter that said, you know, we don't believe in trigger warnings.
Right.
What we believe in is that college is a place where you test ideas.
Right.
We will not cancel speakers because they hurt your feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't like it, too bad, because you know why? We're a real college.
And this is the, as they were saying, it's the commitment to the freedom of inquiry and expression.
Right.
Right.
And, you know, people have attacked the University of Chicago for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's beautiful.
That idea and what you're describing, that's something else that the scholar I was referencing before, Jonathan Haidt, he had written a book recently called The Coddling of the American Mind.
Mm-hmm.
That's all about this. It's all about what had happened at Harvard, what happened, I think, at the Claremont, what happened at Yale. And yeah, the connection back to that, there's still that thread that comes back to happiness again.
Right.
So if anyone's interested, that would definitely be an area to look into as far as what his work was, because it's pretty recent. I think that book came out last year. Well, I think we're getting towards the end of our time here for today's discussion. Any final thoughts, recaps? I mean, as we got towards the end of it here, I think you bullet pointed, you know, some of the key factors for consideration. Anything else, John?
I think part of the happiness thing is, one is, if you're in real depression, you should talk to someone.
So we have the health center on campus, and all the students who are students here have the opportunity to go to the student health center, where they have access to psychological services.
That's free.
It's free. I'm not sure how many hours students have. We should double check on
last
that.
Last time I checked, it was around 10.
10 hours. Okay.
So it's great.
So reaching out, asking for help when you need help, getting, you know, around the sort of stigma that comes with asking for help, of course, important.
Yeah. And I think the other thing, that the bullet points we talked about were all sort of proactive things. Mm-hmm. That there are things that you can do in a change of mindset that often helps navigating college in a way in which you feel joy rather than anxiety.
All right. Well, on that note, thank you, John, for the time and the discussion today.
Okay. Thanks, Scott.